This week on Making Contact.
How was it so easy for the little good kid from Western New York to participate in destroying their community and their villages?
Like many soldiers returning home from Vietnam, former Air Force Captain S. Brian Wilson became a peace activist. One day in 1987, when he lost his legs during a protest against a shipment of weapons, it only strengthened his resolve. It was his way of dealing with what he experienced at war. And now, thousands of new veterans are trying to find their way.
I did it. I went there. I saw it. And I'm ready to get out. I'm ready to get back to a normal life.
On this edition, two generations of veterans cope with PTSD, looking to heal themselves and heal the world. I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Post-traumatic stress disorder. How is this a disorder? What part of being emotionally and spiritually affected by gross violence is a disorder? How about going to war and coming home with a clear conscience disorder? I think that would be far more appropriate.
That was Iraq War veteran Drew Cameron reading a poem written by another vet, Matt Howard. Both Cameron and Howard were contributors to a project called Warrior Writers, Move, Shoot, and Communicate. It's a collection of writing by members of Iraq Veterans Against the War. Writing is just one way the tens of thousands of military vets coming back to the U.S. are trying to deal with what they've seen and taken part of on the battlefield. The need for creative outlets, counseling, and support is immense and growing by the day. Carolyn Kunz's fiancé, Matt Fuller, was a cavalry scout in the 101st Airborne Division of the U.S. Army. The two had just begun their life together when Matt's post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, symptoms became a challenge to their relationship. Between his two deployments in Afghanistan, they discovered their struggles were different than the ones most couples face. In this story from KALW Radio in San Francisco, reporter Lindsay Lee Keel has more.
The door to Carolyn Kuntz's Oakland apartment is covered in a large yellow ribbon with a big bow in the center. The ribbon means she is waiting for a soldier to come home. On the wall of Carolyn's room, there's a line of post-its, a rainbow of numbers counting down from 41, all the weeks until Carolyn's fiancé, Matt Fuller, is officially released from the Army.
Look at this room. It's so funny. Like, that's my countdown. And then those are his ACUs. That's the bag his mom got for me.
Carolyn points at a camouflage jacket of Matt's hanging on a chair near her purse. Also camouflage. On top of the nightstand sits a golden-tinted photograph of Matt and Carolyn, where the young couple kiss like the world doesn't exist outside the frame. On her bed is a doll, dressed in fatigues.
It's Joe.
As in, G.I. Joe.
Joe is a daddy doll. They handed these out free to children who had dads that were deploying, and he kind of went around with me everywhere during this deployment.
Carolyn carries the doll to places Matt can't be, as a symbol of both his presence and absence in her life.
I mean, he missed my 21st birthday and Christmas, which is always a really big deal in my family, but, you know, those are whatever. But he also missed my brother's wedding, which is actually the hardest kind of time of not having him there.
The thing is, Matt has actually been gone for most of their relationship, and it was during his absence that Carolyn began writing about their time together. He was on his first deployment in Afghanistan in 2008 when they met as pen pals.
I'd offered to write to a soldier, and he responded with, "Hi, I'm not a stalker or a weirdo, but you live close to me, so I figured I'd write. So yeah, I promise I'll respond if you write back." How could I resist? We got to know each other over the course of 3 months, talking every day, until finally I was carrying my computer from class to class in the hopes that he'd become available. We both seemed glued to our screens then, and even after hours of typing, we never ran out of things to say.
3 months after they started to write each other, Matt came home on leave.
So he wanted to meet me, and I told him no, like 4 times, and he kept asking me, and I finally said, okay, I'll meet you, fine.
In person, they hit it off.
I had never liked a guy so much.
After Matt went back to Afghanistan, they continued to chat online, eventually typing the words, "I love you." They were able to see each other when Matt's first deployment ended in April of 2009. By May, they were engaged.
He proposed in the parking lot half an hour before I was supposed to go into the airport to fly back home.
Still, something didn't seem right to Carolyn. Something she had noticed the first night they spent together, before they were a couple, after they fell asleep on the floor of Matt's room while watching The Jungle Book.
Every time I moved, he'd bolt upright and look at me and ask if I was okay. And, you know, I was just shifting. Like, I was nervous. I was around this guy I didn't know well. And I remember thinking, that's really weird. He's a really light sleeper, isn't he? But the more time I spent with him, the more I realized that that was normal.
Normal for Matt, because he'd been in combat. But Matt wasn't just a light sleeper. He was anxious. He was having nightmares. Bad ones. Dreams seemed like real threats.
I've gotten shoved out of the bed before. You know, I always thought, like, oh, well, having your loved ones there would be calming. But, you know, it's hard not to kind of get upset by it.
After that first deployment, every time Matt was home on leave, Carolyn noticed the nightmares, the sleep stress, his extreme anxiety in public places. While he was away, she heard the depression in his voice and saw it in his writing. Eventually, he sought help. A psychologist determined that Matt was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. But even though the diagnosis helped explain his feelings and behavior, Carolyn says Matt's symptoms were hard on her and their relationship.
When we were alone or around his friends or his family, he was that guy that really liked you and paid attention to you. He would, you know, be cuddly and be sweet and look me in the eye. And then we went out and it was just a totally different person. He would just shut down.
Carolyn says their struggles weren't the simple misunderstandings of a typical relationship. PTSD made the problems deeper and far more complicated.
When you have somebody that goes to deployment, goes through horrific combat experiences and comes home a different person, I think that's when the really big issues start.
But she didn't give up on him. They went to therapy. They talked about how they felt. Like any couple who wants to make it work, they told each other when they were upset. And Matt tried his best to explain what was happening to him, though he was struggling to understand it himself. Carolyn started writing about his struggles.
About sitting at his computer at home, playing a game, when suddenly a flashback grips him like a quick, vicious tug at his skull, retreating just as quickly and leaving him reeling with emotion, nausea. It's about getting up angry because he knows it isn't real, angry because it feels like he's still stuck in a goddamn miserable, dusty-ass desert. About grabbing his gun and checking every door, every lock, and every inch of the perimeter around his house because he can't shake the feeling that he has to do something to make it better. An enemy he can't fight, and it's right smack dab inside his own head.
After a while, Matt was even able to open up about what his psychologist refers to as the trigger for his PTSD symptoms. He whispered the story to Carolyn one night in bed. Later, she wrote about it.
His convoy had arrived after a bumpy ride on narrow mountain roads, much too small for the Humvees that formed a beige armored snake inching across the Afghanistan desert. It was as they had expected. Two hollowed shells of what was left of the Humvees, the front ends blown off, a black char marking a neat semicircle around where the hood should have been, wires and machinery hanging limply in the open. Inside, they found the customary pink blood splatters against the cracked windshield, small puddles on what was left of the seats. It was what they didn't find that caused concern. There were no bodies. The burned remnants of some boots and lower limbs remained, but that was all. So they were sent out to search, each armed and each wary because they knew what it meant. The enemy had gotten there first. It was someone else that spotted the drag marks through the dust, but they all stood as one to gaze on a scraggly tree draped with severed, mangled body parts like some sort of limited edition Christmas tree. The war edition. He was handed a black plastic bag and told to start picking up the pieces. The families deserved their loved ones' remains, after all. Sometime later, they found the camera stolen off one of the dead soldiers containing pictures of what had happened that day. Hooded faces grinning with joyous triumph in contrast with the gruesome background. The fact that the camera had been recovered from more dead bodies was little consolation. It was supposed to end once they got home, but it didn't.
It didn't end, and his service wasn't over. Matt found out that in August of 2010, he would be redeploying to Afghanistan. The stress of anticipation and preparation was enough to kickstart the anxiety and nightmares. And then, Matt left. Carolyn knows that when he comes home, they will need to start the healing process all over.
I'm hoping it won't be as bad the second time around because we've gone through it and we at least have the tools to know how to deal with situations.
Matt seems to be doing better. His last deployment just ended. He doesn't have as many nightmares. He isn't as depressed or anxious. Here's Matt from his base in Tennessee.
Oh, right now, I feel great. You know, like I said, I'm really excited.
Matt has just a few weeks to go before he gets his honorable discharge and returns to the Bay Area to marry Carolyn.
The Army is a chapter of my life that's getting ready to end. The last page. And, you know, I did it. I went there. I saw it. And I did my time. And I'm ready to get out, you know. Like, no hard feelings towards the Army. But, you know, I just feel like I did my share. And I'm ready to get back to a normal, so to speak, a normal life. And start it with Carolyn there. And I feel great about it.
All right. Bye, baby. I love you.
I love you, too.
Bye.
Bye.
Matt and Carolyn are eager to begin their life together. They're already talking about a house, a dog, and kids. But there will still be things to work through. There will still be therapy.
You fall in love with the person. You don't fall in love with their profession. And I certainly didn't fall in love with PTSD, but it comes with Matt as a package. So I can't pick and choose. And in the end, I do think it's worth it. I think it has made us a much stronger couple because we've dealt with all of the issues head on. You don't have any other choice, but you work through them. And there's a skill set that comes with that, that I think will help us, you know, have a long-lasting marriage and a good life.
Dealing with PTSD does seem to have made Matt and Carolyn stronger. Willing to take on anything to make their relationship work. And really, they are like any young couple in love, happy and optimistic, ready to start a new life, together. For Cross Currents, I'm Lindsay Lee Keel.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
A peaceful protest over weapons shipments to Central America became a scene of horror on Tuesday in Concord, California. Several protesters, led by Brian Wilson, kneeled on railroad tracks to block a Navy weapons train approaching at 5 miles an hour. The engineer reportedly applied the brakes when he saw the protesters, but Brian Wilson didn't get off the tracks in time. He was hit by the
Despite being left in critical condition after being run over by that train, former Air Force Captain S. Brian Wilson survived. In fact, the incident only seemed to strengthen his political activism. But how did a Vietnam soldier turn into a peace activist? How did Wilson turn his trauma into positive action? That's the story Wilson told in July 2011 in Berkeley, California. Wilson was speaking at a benefit for KPFA Radio and to promote his new book, Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson.
The book was written really primarily to answer a question that has been with me ever since I left Vietnam, which was in August of 1969. The question is this: it was a question I was asking me, not the culture, not anybody else but me. How was it so easy for the little good kid from Western, a little farming community in Western New York, how was it so easy to follow an order of another man to go halfway, well, 9,000 miles from my hometown to another country to participate in destroying their community and their villages? It's pretty absurd, really. It became something beyond comprehension to me, and I kind of kept putting it aside, because I wasn't sure I wanted to answer the question. But I felt it went to the essence of the human condition. I really wanted to know how it was so easy to be dumbed down, be so successfully adaptive to the mores of my society, which made me, in my mind, very dehumanized. It took going to Vietnam for me to recognize how dehumanized I had become. Now, I was raised in a very right-wing family, both in terms of politics and religion. But for me, when I was young, sports was everything. Ideology wasn't very important to me. And by the mid-60s, I was very much a continued believer in killing the commies, protecting freedom and democracy from all those evil people. But I wanted to stay in graduate school. And so in those days, that was called a chicken hawk. You were a hawk on the war, but you were a chicken. You didn't want to fight in the war. But I got stuck. I got drafted. I had no reason to get out of it because I didn't have any politics or philosophy that would suggest I should try to escape. So instead of going in the Army after I was drafted, I enlisted in the Air Force for 4 years and became an officer, thinking that was the easy way out. I would make more money. My third year in the Air Force, I was, after being a plush assignment in Washington, D.C., in Headquarters Air Force, I was ordered to become what I would call a low-level commander of an Air Force Ranger unit to be trained at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, to go to Vietnam with 40 men and protect air bases from attacks. I didn't want the assignment, but, you know, I was in the military and you follow orders. And I'd always been very loyal and obedient. So on March 8th, we landed in the Mekong Delta. Got off the plane. Actually, the base was under an attack. And it was almost midnight. So there I was in a bunker hearing explosions, thinking, wow, I don't know. I really didn't want to be here. So my men became the combat security unit that was on the perimeter of the base. And so we had the heavy machine guns, the starlight scopes, the anti-personnel radar, the outgoing mortar units. And, you know, we were always subject to attacks fairly regularly. But I was given an extra duty by the Vietnamese base commander, which was to assess the success or failure of airstrikes on targets. And there was a lot of pressure to up the number of body counts that could be attributed to success of the war. And the rumor was that some of these pilots were, quote-unquote, VC, were going to sabotage their targets. So he wanted a U.S. officer to go and just do some spot checking. I didn't think much about it. I was pretty naive. It was not a dangerous mission at all because it was daytime. And the very first village we went to was around April 12th or 13th, 1969, in Vinh Long province in the Delta. And as we got out of the Jeep, the smoke was coming up behind the tall elephant grass. And I heard a roar to my right, which was just water buffalo with a third of its skull gone and a big gash in its belly, just screaming in pain. And I was already in shock just from that. And then I turned to my left, and there were all these bodies in the smoke, and all the buildings were burning or already had burned. And I started walking to my left. And I couldn't walk any further because there was bodies there. I just couldn't walk anymore. And by this time, I was even more shocked. I think I was actually maybe crying, or I was throwing up bile juice or something. I was actually quite physiologically affected by the scene. I got to the point where I couldn't walk any further, and I looked down and I saw this woman with three children, clutching three children. They were all dead, as were most of the people on the ground. Some were moaning, so they were still alive. I could smell the napalm in the air, the burning flesh, and the chemical residue from the weapons. And I had this experience of looking at that woman's eyes, because she was lying on her back looking up, I thought, at me, realizing that the napalm had burned her eyelids and her facial skin, but her eyes were looking, I experienced it as her eyes were looking at my eyes, my eyes were looking at her eyes. At that moment, I got it. She and I are the same. It was kind of an overwhelming experience, an epiphany, realizing that she and I were part of the same family. I was 9,000 miles from my hometown in upstate New York. She was in her village. And it struck me how absurd this was, how criminal, how diabolical. But it was a moment of irreversible knowledge in my viscera. I just could not forget it. And I knew very quickly after that that everything I had learned growing up in our society was probably a lie. So that was the beginning of my, what I like to think of as the real Brian Wilson, who was going to be recovering from conditioning, the heavy conditioning of being an obedient servant of the nation state. That began a journey that's still happening. So I started examining the whole model of Western civilization, the whole model of industrial civilization. It's built on many levels of exploitation and plunder, meaning somebody was in the way of the exploitation, and they were treated as if they were nothing. And I started having experiences in my travels. I went in the 70s, I went to many prisons all over the United States because I was working as a lawyer, but not in the courtroom. But I also began to realize that I had to go deeper into the whole social economic base upon which our values are formed, that the criminal injustice system itself is really a smokescreen for enabling the basic society to stay intact and have this group of people they can identify as the problems in our society. When I had been, had this experience of witnessing village after village after village of being destroyed by bombs, and they were not considered crimes by my country. They were considered acts for which the pilots were rewarded. Pretty amazing, really. Then I started going to Central America, studying Reagan's policies in El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala. And I was seeing more and more of this devastation, this killing of people, this maiming of people as if they didn't count. And again, I was feeling incredible connection to these people, like they are the same as me. What on earth are we doing? How can we do this? And of course, I was doing what others were doing. I was petitioning Congress in those days to uphold international law and not be killing innocent people. And of course, they just kept funding it and using different language to justify it. I always got great noble sounding rhetoric to justify anything. And that's what those experiences led me to the tracks, because Concord was the source of the weapons going to Central America. And we couldn't count on Congress to change the law or stop funding. So we thought, okay, we'll just go and block the trains, knowing that the trains are likely to continue to go, but not without having to arrest people saying, you can't move these munitions in my name. So that's what led me to the tracks with other people in the summer of 1987. It didn't seem like a very complicated process to me in terms of my own thinking and feeling and expression. And it was not certainly dangerous, because the trains have a 5-mile-an-hour speed limit. There's a definite protocol about how to remove protesters from the tracks before they move the train. I had been an installation security officer in the military. I knew that commanders of bases do not take chances with munitions when they're moving them. There was 350 armed Marines, at Concord at the time. So I was not worried about a dangerous situation. I was very aware that I was likely to go to jail. So when I woke up in the hospital 4 days after I was struck, I have no memory of it to this day, I couldn't believe what people were telling me. I was run over by the train. But we did find out that the train crew that day was ordered not to stop the train. There was a belief, or at least they stated this, that I and the two others who were blocking the trains that day were going to hijack the train. 2 or 3 days later, however, the FBI agent Jack Ryan in Peoria, Illinois, was fired for refusing to investigate Duncan Murphy and I, who were two of the three men on the tracks, as domestic terrorist suspects. So I started getting the picture.
That was Vietnam veteran and author S. Brian Wilson. His newest book is titled Blood on the Tracks, The Life and Times of S. Brian Wilson. To hear his full-length speech, along with a question and answer session, log on to our website, radioproject.org. We close out our show with a poem by Drew Cameron, who served with the U.S. Army in Iraq in 2003.
We build more walls. Coming across the country, you see a lot of things. You see the political landscape, you see the suburban landscape, transportation landscape, but you also see a lot of walls. It's something that we can be really proud of as humanity, is our ability to build walls, both the physical, the literal ones, and the ones that we build up inside of ourselves. The shield off, your conscience, your reflection. Whether it's a wall in Berlin with Ronald Reagan standing in front of it. Tear down this wall! Remember that? It was just a wee little pup. And sure enough, people came out there with their shoes and their hammers, scraps of wood, and they tore down that wall. Or whether it's the walls in Baghdad, the Jersey barriers, these massive concrete barriers running through people's homes and marketplaces that were once the same place are now separated by these walls. Or whether it be the wall in the southern border of this country, springing up with our neighbors to the north. Or the walls that we build inside of ourselves through wearing something like this. An identity veteran, shame to find. It can be that, but it doesn't have to be. Because ecologically, environmentally, our sanctity is on its knees. We have choked the rivers and burned the trees, but tomorrow is more than just another day. We build more walls than we tear down. Iraqi sands in a southern town. The movement isn't done. Cloistered times and freedom crimes. Our children's lives, a shadow army dines. These occupations are in our faces and in our homes. But together, we are more than what we have. Combat paper is about taking down walls. We can take apart a wall, but it's important to think about what we rebuild with it. Because we can just build another.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Special thanks to KPFA Radio and Raising Sand Radio at KZSU at Stanford. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get our podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like Making Contact on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.